this to continue. What we are asking for is that people in Gaza have food and have medicine, and we need to lift the siege on Gaza, because this siege, which is now intensified, did not start today. Gaza has been under siege since 2007. And now we are in the bleakest stages of this siege. Gaza is not only now under siege, but it's under genocide. So this is very scary. And I hope the world will not continue to watch and just show us that they are helpless in the face of Israel. And if you can't get food into Gaza, can you please stop the shipping of weapons into Israel? Because they are killing us every day.
I wanted to ask you about the International Court of Justice, which has just concluded its six-day hearing on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. This is Ralph Wild, a representative of the League of Arab States.
The occupation must end. Israel must renounce its claim to sovereignty over the Palestinian territory. All settlers must be removed immediately. This is required to end the illegality, to discharge the positive obligation to enable immediate Palestinian self-administration, and because Israel lacks any legal entitlement to exercise authority. Second, in the absence of the occupation ending, necessarily, everything Israel does in the Palestinian territory lacks a valid international legal basis and is, therefore, subject to the Namibia exception, invalid. Not only those things violating the law regulating the conduct of the occupation. Those norms entitle and require Israel to do certain things. But this doesn't alter the more fundamental position from the law on the use of force and self-determination that Israel lacks any valid authority to do anything. And whatever it does is illegal, even if compliant with or pursuant to the conduct regulatory rules. I will close by quoting Palestinian academic and poet Rifat Alaria from his final poem posted 36 days before he was killed by Israel in Gaza on the 6th of December, 2023. If I must die, you must live to tell my story.
That was Ralph Wild, a representative of the League of Arab States, quoting the late Palestinian poet Rafat Alarir. Masaba Butoha, you were a close friend of Rafat. Can you respond to what he said?
Well, I'm still wondering how Israel could be still a member of the United Nations when we know that it is occupying Palestinian lands. I mean, this is, I think, one condition through which Israel joined the United Nations, I think, in the early 1950s, was to stand by, you know, the borders that were set after the partition plan. But now Israel occupies more than 90% of the Palestinian land. I think what Rifat is asking is how the world is, you know, is unable to control a state that they continue to fund. I mean, they can't control it, but they continue to fund it, and they continue to cut the funds to the United Nations organization that is trying to support the Palestinian people, not during this genocide, but UNRWA has been supporting people, and I was educated in their schools, and I went to their clinics and got medications for free, and now they are cutting their funding during the most critical time of our lives in Gaza and also in other parts of the world. So this really drives me insane, because the world is pretending to be unable to do anything, but they do the opposite. They continue to fund Israel. They send it weapons. They send Israel more fruit and more vegetables and more wheat flour and more gas. But they say, okay, we can't stop Israel from killing children. And I mean, I hope that someone would come to explain this to me one time. And also one last point before I end with my answer is that how many officials from the world came to Gaza to meet with the real people there? If they are saying that that Gaza is all Hamas, can you please come to Gaza and meet my mother, my brother, my sibling, Ali, who is now 10 days old? Can you come and meet them and listen to them, what they are asking for? But it was easy for them to go to Israel and meet with the monsters there who are waging the war and who are inciting to kill more and more people. But they never came to Gaza. I think there is one reason for that, because Gaza does not have an airport. So it was easy for them to fly and land in the land of Israel because they have an airport. But maybe one reason they couldn't come to Gaza is that Gaza does not have an airport. I mean, I could try to understand that.
Mazhab Abu Toha, we want to thank you for being with us. Palestinian poet, author, teacher, founder of the Edward Said Library in Gaza. We will link to your new piece in the New Yorker magazine, headlined My Family's Daily Struggle to Find Food in Gaza. His award-winning book is titled Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to damning new projections about the health crisis unfolding in Gaza. In a minute, we'll be joined by one of the lead authors of a joint report from the London School of Hygiene and Johns Hopkins University, which found, quote, even in the best-case ceasefire scenario, thousands of excess deaths would continue to occur, mainly due to the time it would take to improve water sanitation and shelter conditions, reduce malnutrition, and restore functioning health care services in Gaza, unquote. In an interview with CNN last week, the regional emergency director of the World Health Organization, Dr. Richard Brennan, was asked about the report's projections.
This study is absolutely striking. I don't know how many wake-up calls we need to alert us to the dire, absolutely dire and desperate situation on the ground. We've already lost 29,000 people from traumatic injuries. We already have over 70,000 others that have survived injuries, with some terrible injuries. I was in Gaza last week. You can't imagine the deformities, the limb losses of young children, young adolescents, young adults who are going to be left with these disabilities for years to come. We don't know how many people have died because they didn't get access to their blood pressure medicines or their diabetic treatment and so on. But we know that we suspect that thousands more have died unnecessarily because of lack of access to health care. And now you have these two reputable institutions. I know the two study leaders. No one is better placed to do these kind of estimates than these two institutions. And now we're saying if things continue, if we see this escalation, if we see this military operation into Rafah, we're going to be looking at an extra 80-odd thousand deaths in 6 months' time. If that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is.
That was the World Health Organization's Regional Emergency Director, Dr. Richard Brennan. For more, we're joined in London by Zeina Jamaluddin. She's a nutritionist, an epidemiologist, one of the lead authors of this new joint report from the London School of Hygiene and Johns Hopkins titled Crisis in Gaza, Scenario-Based Health Impact Projections. She's a research fellow at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Zeina, welcome to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Just lay out your findings.
Hello, welcome. So as that was just mentioned, in fact, we have attempted to actually project what would be the excess mortality in different scenarios in Gaza. In fact, we know that there is the direct effect of the war, but however, we also wanted to understand what is the indirect effect of the war on infectious diseases, for example, mortality from COVID-19, increased excess mortality from maternal and newborn healthcare because they're not able to access health services, increased mortality due to the chronic diseases for specifically type 1 diabetic patient, people with chronic kidney diseases, and how much excess mortality would happen due to this. We also modeled the impact of acute malnutrition, which is what was just mentioned right now in terms of how much wasting or thin children would increase as an underlying factor to all of this excess death. So what, with this attempt, we actually find that in case of a ceasefire, around 6,000 to 11,000 lives would actually be dead, and would have an excess death in the case of a ceasefire of around 11,000 deaths. In case of an escalation, we'd see around 85,000 deaths, which is currently what's happening in Rafah and in the next 6 months. But also what's important to point out is in case of a ceasefire now, we would be saving around 75,000 lives.
Can you respond to this latest news of the two-month-old baby boy, the Palestinian child, who died on Friday of starvation?
Yes, of course. So basically, before the war, we know that in terms of wasting, which is means that thin children, the prevalence or the level in Gaza was around 3%. The majority of the population in Gaza was heavily reliant on food assistance. This was 77% of the population relied on assistance coming in. With the current food trucks being very limited coming into Gaza, we actually modeled the decrease in the food availability currently in Gaza, the decrease in agricultural land available in Gaza, but also the decrease in the food truck coming into Gaza, to actually understand what is the caloric intake that is happening currently, to understand the increase in malnutrition or wasting. What we project, in fact, is that on to date, we see a prevalence of around 12% of children under five that are wasting. We would also project that in the next few months, in the case of an escalation, this would reach to 26%, which is classified as catastrophic. In the next 6 months, the prevalence would reach 50%. So basically, responding to what you're saying, we're actually currently starting to see the critical phase of acute malnutrition being portrayed.
What would solve this, Zeina?
A ceasefire, first of all. A significant increase in food access, whether it's also through airdrops and through allowing all the food trucks and also medical aid to come in without any restrictions.
I wanted to ask you about how casualties are prefaced, especially in the Western media. Your piece for The Lancet in November is titled Excess Mortality in Gaza, October 7th to 26, 2023. So many news media in the West preface casualty figures by saying, quote, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas, which has led so many to question the veracity of the figures. What did you find?
So when the Ministry of Health has released the first listing of people who were killed during October, we, as epidemiologists, took this data and actually analyzed to understand what is happening in terms of duplication and the accuracy of the data. We have analyzed it as London School separately, but also Hopkins University has analyzed it. And we both find that there is no reason to actually doubt the accuracy of this data. There's another aspect of it all to say that in previous war, the Ministry of Health data has been validated and from different independent sources. At the same time, this is the same system that the Ministry of Health has used previously for COVID-19 reporting or other mortality estimation and reporting. So it's important to note that this didn't start at the beginning of the war of reporting mortality. And so they relied on this system. But we did assess the accuracy and we find no reason to doubt these data sets or the numbers reported by the Ministry of Health.
Well, Zeina Jamaluddin, we want to thank you so much for being with us, nutritionist and epidemiologist, one of the lead authors of the new joint report from the London School of Hygiene and Johns Hopkins titled Crisis in Gaza, Scenario-Based Health Impact Projections. She's a research fellow at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. We'll link to that report. Next up, anti-Palestinian at the core. We look at the origins and growing dangers of U.S. anti-terrorism law. Stay with us. Of the Century by Ornette Coleman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how Palestinians are being increasingly targeted by U.S. anti-terrorism laws amidst ongoing efforts to conflate pro-Palestinian activism with so-called terrorism. The Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, has called on university presidents to investigate Students for Justice in Palestine, known as SJP chapters, for, quote, material support for terrorism. ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt has even compared SJP to the Hitler Youth.
Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And the SJP and these kids who are pushing it are like the Hitler Youth. Sorry, I know people don't like it when I say that, but it's true. And what Shai said before is spot on.
Meanwhile, several American universities have suspended or banned Students for Justice in Palestine. In an interview in January with CNN's Dana Bash, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi claimed without evidence some protesters demanding a ceasefire in Gaza are connected to Russia and urged the FBI to investigate them.
But for them to call for a ceasefire is Mr. Putin's message. Mr. Putin's message. Make no mistake, this is directly connected to what he would like to see. Same thing with Ukraine. It's about Putin's message. I think some of these protesters are spontaneous and organic and sincere. Some, I think, are connected to Russia. And I say that having looked at this for a long time now, as you know.
You think some of these protests are Russian plants?
I don't think they're plants. I think some financing should be investigated. And I want to ask the FBI to investigate that.
She later would say when people were protesting in San Francisco, go back to China. For more, we're joined by two guests who've been following all of this closely. Darrell Lee is an anthropologist and lawyer teaching at University of Chicago. He's the author of the new briefing paper, Anti-Palestinian at the Core, The Origins and Growing Dangers of U.S. Anti-Terrorism Law, jointly published with the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal. And we're joined by Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Darrell Lee, let's start with you. Talk about what you found.
Good morning, Amy. It's good to be with you. Well, I think many viewers of Democracy Now! Are probably familiar with the way that Palestinians have been slandered and stereotyped as terrorists for a long time. What this report does is it reaches back and connects the dots of a longer history, going back almost 50 years, showing how the very foundations of terrorism law in the United States at key moments of their development were crafted with the agenda of opposing or crushing Palestinian liberation in mind. The first time the word terrorism even shows up in federal law is in a 1969 statute, and it's unfortunately very relevant today. This statute restricts U.S. aid to UNRWA, the UN body that provides humanitarian aid to refugees, and it uses the word terrorism essentially as a synonym for Palestinian resistance. And one of the chief sponsors of this legislation, Congressman Leonard Farbstein from New York, made a speech on the floor of the House of Representatives where he peddled the stereotype of UNRWA schools and Palestinian refugee camps essentially as hotbeds of terrorism that are brainwashing the sort of next generation of terrorists. So in light of today's campaigns to defund UNRWA and to deprive Palestinians of humanitarian aid, we can see that this is part of a much, much longer campaign that extends in many different directions.
Can you talk about who is pushing these laws and what their agenda is, Darley?
Yes, one of the other key aspects of the story is the role of organizations like the Anti-Defamation League in pushing for this legislation over time. And again, this is relevant for one of the clips that you just played, the clip of Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, accusing student activists, SJP, of terrorism support, of being terrorism supporters. There's a bit of a coming full circle moment here, because the ADL was actually one of the organizations that lobbied very heavily for the passage of this law that criminalizes so-called material support to terrorist organizations. The material support statute is actually the most commonly used charge in federal terrorism cases. And the reason why it's prosecutors' favorite tool is because it is incredibly broad. It criminalizes ordinary activity that would usually be covered and protected by the First Amendment. So it's a very, very convenient weapon. And it was passed in the 1990s as the result of a long-running campaign by the ADL and other groups to essentially crack down on Palestinian community organizing and Palestinian solidarity organizing in the United States. And what they did actually was they exploited the outrage following the 1995 bombing of a federal building in Oklahoma City. Now, many people will recall, of course, that the people who carried out that bombing were U.S. citizens, essentially right-wing white nationalist militia members. But the law that was passed as a result of the Oklahoma City bombing included, it was mostly a sort of get tough on crime, crackdown on immigration bill that included the material support law that was proposed by the ADL as part of a larger package of measures that were all about essentially targeting Palestinian liberation movements.
And Dima Khalidi, head of Palestine Legal, let's be clear, it's not only Students for Justice in Palestine that have been banned on some campuses, but also Jewish Voice for Peace.
That's right, Amy. We've seen over the last several months multiple efforts to shut down student activism, and that is a direct result of efforts by groups like the ADL, but also by statements by President Biden himself that have said that he is mobilizing federal law enforcement to surveil campus activism. And these threats of surveillance that Pelosi herself made as well are serious, and they reflect what we are saying in this report is a fundamentally anti-Palestinian agenda. When the U.S. government, instead of stopping military aid to Israel to stop this genocide, is stopping funding for UNRWA, that is a lifeline for Gazans. This is the result of decades of anti-Palestinian rhetoric that has allowed these laws to develop, and that is ultimately, in this moment when people are mobilizing to stop this genocide, a cover for the genocide. It is a justification for the dehumanization of Palestinians and their allies, to tar them with criminal or discriminatory intent. And that's the intention of this report, is to really expose this anti-Palestinian agenda that is driving efforts to really expand these laws to target First Amendment activity that is trying to mobilize people for justice.
Palestine Legal has received multiple reports of the FBI harassing Palestine advocates for their social media posts. Can you describe some examples, Dima?
Well, we and other legal organizations that are supporting people who are facing increasing repression are getting multiple reports of people being visited by the FBI. Often because of social media posts that they make, because of their activism on the streets. And people have even been visited by ICE, immigration enforcement agencies. And this is a direct result, again, of this rhetoric, of this increase in surveillance resources to law enforcement agencies. And as we know from the post 9/11 era, the impact on our communities is enormous. It has a huge chilling effect on people, on First Amendment rights. But it also is a signal of an erosion of a whole host of constitutional rights when law enforcement is mobilized in this way, as we saw in the 1960s with COINTELPRO, as we saw in the post 9/11 era. So this is just the beginning, we think, of what is a massive mobilization of state resources against this movement. And this is why we're publishing this report now, to really encourage lawmakers to protect First Amendment rights, to roll back these laws which are only shielding Israel from accountability and scrutiny and undermining fundamental First Amendment rights for everybody.
Can you talk about the anti-Palestinian bills that are in front of Congress tonight? One of them that would possibly radically expand deportations of Palestinians at this time, Dima?
Yeah, we're seeing legislatures around the country, not just Congress, but state legislatures threatening, presenting bills that are trying to justify an erosion of constitutional rights and First Amendment rights by noting terrorism, supposed terrorism threats, right? And certainly after October 7th, we saw an increase in these kinds of bills, one that wanted to deport all Palestinians. And we see this rhetoric from our elected officials as well. So we are very clear that the reason that this is allowed to happen is because this anti-Palestinian sentiment has been cemented not only into U.S. law, but into the minds of people. And that's why these kinds of bills are proposed with hardly anyone blinking an eye, while Palestinians are being obliterated in Gaza as we speak. So this is a very concerning moment, and one where we must all stand up and recognize that our laws are have been built and are being used and exploited to further the Israel's own agenda, and you know, the United States' complicity in what Israel is doing right now.
Dara Lee, can you talk about what most surprised you in this last minute we have in doing the research for this report?
Yes. Well, I think one of the surprising episodes is the one that I referred to earlier about the way that the material support law was passed after the Oklahoma City bombing. Essentially, what happened was that the Clinton administration proposed a sort of general anti-terrorism law that included the things that the ADL wanted, that essentially targeted Palestinians, but also included things that you would expect, like expanded law enforcement authority, regulation of firearms and explosives, and so on. And the House-led, the Republican-led House of Representatives essentially gutted that bill and replaced it with all of the provisions that they wanted. And immediately, the Democrats and the ADL pushed back, lobbied very hard, and the parts of the original bill, only the ones that pertained to so-called international terrorism that were essentially targeting Palestinians, were put back into the bill. So it's a really sobering example of how anti-Palestinian animus is one of the most enduring areas of bipartisan appeal in Washington.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We're going to link to your report. Dara Lee, lawyer, associate professor of anthropology and social sciences at the University of Chicago, and Dima Khalidi, founder and director of Palestine Legal. The new briefing paper is Anti-Palestinian at the Core: The Origins and Growing Dangers of U.S. Anti-Terrorism Law. That does it for our show. To see all our video and audio podcasts, you can go to democracynow.org. And congratulations to our whole team as we just surpassed 2 million YouTube viewers. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Faust, Mike Burke, Dina Gezdusher, Doug Caduce, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's March, and you know what that means. It's les rendezvous de la francophonie.
Check out rvf.ca to discover all the activities and contests happening across Canada.
Hi, Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it. Do you